Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is James Anderson. James, a native of the Pacific Northwest, born in Seattle, raised in Portland, and a graduate of Reed College. He founded Brighton Bush Books, a small publishing company based in Portland, and ran it from 1976 to 1991. In addition to writing and publishing, James has worked as a logger, commercial fisherman, car salesman, and truck driver. He's in the studio today to talk about his debut novel, The Never Open Desert Diner, which the New York Times called a wondrously strange first novel. James Anderson, thanks for being here on Between the Covers.
It's wonderful to be here, Ken.
James, The Never Open Desert Diner is your first published novel, and you're 63, so there's a lot of life leading up to this, and a very full and fascinating life. Can we start with a little about your childhood, which was not an easy one from what I've read?
Well, I guess in retrospect, it can seem it wasn't easy. I was raised by a single mother in the 50s. Women were marginalized even more than they are today. She worked alongside men for half the pay, and childcare was tough to come by, and so my sister and I sort of fended for ourselves. In fact, her parting words to us every morning were, "Don't kill each other till I get home." It was also a wonderful childhood in the sense that my sister and I became very self-reliant. We started cooking for ourselves when we were five and doing our own laundry and everything else. And if we didn't do it, it didn't get done. So, and we were free to kind of roam the world.
And then how did you get from there to Reed College? Another local reference here.
Oh, you know, this is a... You get to a point in life where you wonder, well, is this really true? But my sister tells me it is true. When I was about 7 or 8, the school said that I had a problem. So my mother somehow found money to take me to a psychiatrist who gave me a bunch of tests and then proceeded to tell my mother that I was, in the word of the day, retarded. And that sort of followed me throughout, you know, elementary school and everything else. Even into high school, yeah. And I was a terrible student. I never did any homework. I rarely showed up. But I was reading. I was reading stuff that never got assigned in high school. I finished my first novel when I was 16. I had a very active, wonderful, intellectual life, apart from the educational process. But the result was is that there was no way I was going to go to college. I couldn't get in. And I started at a college seminary, Mount Angel. And it was wonderful. You know, the priests and the nuns, it was very small. It was under 200. But then they closed for lack of funds. But by then, I'd gotten a decent transcript, so I transferred to Southern Oregon College, mm-hmm. and I got excellent grades there, and then transferred to Reed. So the journey to Reed was involved, and I had to kind of earn my way there. But once at Reed, all the A's I got everywhere else changed to D's and C's,
but Reed is a high bar.
Yeah, there was something about the Reed experience which was a lot like the monastic experience at seminary at Mount Angel.
Academically, rather than
religiously. I mean, the library is open all night long, and most of the learning happens outside, and I found this true generally in life, happens outside of class. So that's where you discuss what happened and what you think and so on.
And at Reed, in your senior year, you started this very successful independent press, Brighton Bush Books.
Oh, yeah. You know, Mark.
Was that a senior thesis? Or?
No. I did my senior thesis it was the very first critical work, and I'm dignifying it by calling it critical, but it was the first critical work on the beat poet Lou Welch. Who was at Reed with Phil Whalen and Gary Snyder and so on. So that's what I did my thesis on. But no, I got a $500 student art grant to do the first little book from Reed. Some people you have to hit over the head numerous times before they get the message. But and so from that, I did Peter Sears, a little book by Peter Sears about teaching poetry. And then the third book was the entry into the big time. It was the Collected Poems of Mary Barnard, who is, of course, the seminal translator of Sappho. And won a lot of awards and was widely reviewed. And at that point, it was sort of off and running. But when I started... When I started the company, I was just 22.
And that was around 1976 when you started
it? Yeah, 75, something like
that. And then you were basically a publisher then. Brighton Bush Books prospered up until about 1991.
You know, I'm not sure I would ever say it prospered. It survived. I love books. And the idea that you could actually take something that didn't exist and make it into a thing of beauty that then gets sent out to the world. And Mark Twain once said that the only two things you needed to be a publisher were arrogance and ignorance. And at 22, I had both in quite
yes,
a supply.
It's a good age for both. And before you wrote this book, then what in all those years at Brighton Bush, what were some of the lessons you learned about publishing and even writing?
Well, I thought I knew, and I have to admit, I still think I know, what constitutes great writing, or at least writing that's worthy of being shared, that's going to make a difference in someone's life. And then I learned about book craft, about binding and design and letting and M spaces and all kinds of things. I worked in the early years, I worked with John Larson, Press 22, who is considered one of the great custom master printers in the United States. And so our books were, the content, I believe, was wonderful, but the physical presentation of the books were amazing. They were just beautiful books, carefully designed. We looked at what the text was, and then instead of dumping everything into a format, looked at the story or the poems, how they looked at the page, how it was presented, and then designed the book around that. So the two complemented each other.
And you had mentioned you could recognize literature and books that would mean something, of course, to the reader. Were there any particular characteristics there? Or is it just something you'll know it when you see it?
Well, it started out that I was seeing so much what I felt was really good writing. I mean, something with heart and mind and attention to craft, and that I wanted to share that with the world. And the way it worked for me was, as things progressed, I was seeing more and more manuscripts. At one point, you know, we had a room the size of the studio just with manuscripts waiting to be read.
Oh my.
You know, But what happened was is that I began to notice that as I was going through manuscripts, if I found myself into a manuscript, because we publish nonfiction and novels and short stories and poetry as well as general interest nonfiction, that if I found myself 20, 30, 40, 50 pages into something, had lost track of time, had become intimately involved. So the critical apparatus, the editorial apparatus, just disappeared. I was no longer looking at sentences or paragraphs or whatever I was caught up in. That was usually a pretty good sign that this is something that we need to pay attention to.
Almost kind of like a flow.
Yes. I mean, because, you know, you've got so much stuff to read. And one of the things in the later years of Bright and Bush, I had less and less time to be involved in the literary process, the editorial process, and so on. We had two great managing editors, Paul Merchant and Tom Booth, who's now with OSU Press. But time was at a premium. But all of a sudden, when you're involved in reading something, and it's just like, no, you're turning the manuscript pages. That's a pretty good sign.
So let's make the transition now from publishing a publisher to author, and brings us to your novel, The Never Open Desert Diner. The obvious question, you're 63 now.
Yes.
And so
that's obvious.
I didn't mean it quite like that. I knew it from the bio. But of course, why now for publishing a novel? And you had mentioned you wrote one back when you were 15, and even in the bio, apparently you had written about 8 before that weren't published.
Yes. Well, part of the reason they weren't published is because I didn't try and publish them. And we were talking before the interview about questions that have been asked and how I've answered them in the past. And, you know, I often said, well, you know, I decided to do this because I'm 63, and you reach a stage in your life where if there's something you really want to do, you probably better do it. Well, that's true as far as it goes. But I think the deeper answer is fear. I worked with amazing people over the years, and some as friends, some as authors, and I saw how difficult it is to get published, and how things don't always turn out the way you hope. You get bad reviews. People say mean things. All of this sort of thing. And then just the quality of what you do. And I just didn't want to throw my hat into that ring. I was afraid it wasn't good enough. And but just afraid of getting noticed or not getting noticed, getting appreciated or not getting appreciated. I didn't realize until later in life that's not what it's about. What it's about is the joy of the blank page. Michael Chabon said a wonderful thing a few years ago. He said, you know, you have to really enjoy the blank page because it's the only thing that you have any control over. Whether the work gets published, how it's received, whether it sells, whether it wins an award, doesn't matter. The blank page. You have to love the blank page. And I got to that point because as you get older, kind of the fear goes away because you just don't care anymore. You know?
It's overcoming the fear then as you get older.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're listening to Between the Covers on KBOO. Today we're talking with James Anderson, author of the new novel, The Never Open Desert Diner. I read that you started The Never Open Desert Diner as a way to pass the time. You were helping a friend kick a heroin habit.
Yeah, that's true.
And you were just kind of fooling around with writing the book. You had mentioned on actual hotel or motel stationery.
What had happened was that I had a friend who I took into my home, had a heroin addiction. And trying to help, and that person proceeded to steal me blind. Part of what they stole was my computer with a novel on it that I'd been working on for 5 years. By the way, I eventually got that computer back and the novel was still on it, but that was some months later. But this person was being stalked by drug dealers. Money was involved, and so we kind of hit the road, and this person was going through withdrawal, which is ugly, and I needed something to read. And I don't, like Robert Parker, who wrote the Spencer novels, once told me, he said, I wrote my first novel because I had the Raymond Chandler novels memorized and I just wanted to read another one. And so the only way to do it was to write it. So I was really trying to entertain myself, and it was a very peripatetic existence, moving around from hotel to hotel. So I turned the protagonist into a truck driver.
And you mentioned Raymond Chandler, the novel, which I loved, and it's
Thank
a
you.
True page-turner. I can't imagine you getting a bad review on it. Actually, I've read almost all rave reviews. I would describe it as kind of a noirish mystery, and certainly reminiscent of Chandler. In the book, you mentioned Ross McDonald, James Crumley, some other iconic mystery chiller writers, thriller writers, from even several Humphrey Bogart movies like High Sierra. Uh-huh. There's a little piece of the Treasure of Sierra Madre in there, too.
Yes,
and I
yes.
won't give away the end here. So who and what were your actual influences when you sat down, to kind of amuse yourself by starting the book?
One of the things that I'm going to speak about at my appearance in Powell's is literary influences, because one of the questions that's come up a lot is, how long did it take you to write this book? Well, the short answer is 6 months to rough draft, followed by 2.5 years and 14 major revisions. But the real answer is all my life. And that's the same for every artist. You put everything you remember, everything you've forgotten, everything you've read, everything you've felt, somehow it all works its way in to that. It informs that work. So It's a weird bunch of influences. Of course, you know, there's that the sort of detective fiction and the stuff that I really like James Lee Burke, and Dennis Lehane and John D. MacDonald. It wasn't so much about the plot. It's about relationships. It's about their friends kind of coming and going, and I believe noir literature really is the literature of the oppressed and the marginalized, because you're fighting for a little light for someone in a dark world. But when you look at what my influences were, it was not just, you know, the Chandler and Bob Parker and John D. MacDonald and James Crumley and so on. It was also Terry Tempest Williams. It was in the nonfiction writers, Barry Lopez, Gretel Ehrlich, my friend Bruce Berger, all of these influences. And then also Thomas Merton. He translated a wonderful book little stories about the third century Christian ascetics who lived in the desert, called Wisdom of the Desert Fathers. So, and then you kind of throw in a little Marquez and, you know, it all of these things kind of get stirred up in a strange way, and you kind of tell your story. But all these people, all these influences, and also, you know, Ursula Le Guin. And oh my goodness, one of the big influences on me was Catherine Dunn.
Oh, yes.
You know, I mean...
So several Portland influences.
Oh, well, yes.
Catherine Dunn wrote Geek Love.
Yeah, I mean, and thing about Geek Love was the voice, you know, I am not... Some people call this a crime novel. Some say it's mystery. Some people just say it's a meditation on place. It's really all kinds of things, which is one of the things that concerned me about the book, because I figured, well, the hardcore mystery people are going to go, nah, and the literary people are going to go, nah, which is going to leave me with nothing in between. But it turns out that both sides embraced it, which is tremendously gratifying. But I'm not so much concerned with the crime, how a crime is committed and how it unfolds. I believe that we don't care about crimes until we care about the people involved. A crime never has just one victim. There are multiple victims, sometimes stretching out over generations, who were maybe not even alive when the original crime took place, but they're still suffering from the fallout of that crime. And so you have the timeless quality of the desert, and also, in a way, the timeless quality of a crime.
Yeah, you mentioned two things that I'd like to get a little bit more into. The sense of place, and you had mentioned some writers where setting and landscape is extremely important, like mm-hmm. James Lee Burke, the South, Dennis Lehane, New England. Mm-hmm. And here it's the desert, and it's a desert highway in Utah. A barren desert highway. I looked up Highway 117 and I found some information on it, but in the book, I think you fictionalize it quite a bit. You even have on the inside front and back cover a map here, which doesn't exist in real life.
There is
one town that does, Price, Utah, and then the rest. There's no Rock Muse, Utah, at least not that I was able to find. But it's very realistic, and you really get a sense of what it's like to live here, living with the heat and these flash floods and rainstorms and the changing weather and the isolation of it all. I think that also informs the characters. They seem very much part of the desert environment. Are they based on people that you knew in this region? And I also want to know how familiar you are with the Utah desert and highways like this.
Pretty familiar. There's this incredible fullness of nothing in the desert that I love, and I think that, you know, when it comes to what's true, no, all of those things are made up. That whole world, I wanted to create a world. I think that's part of what happens in great fiction. You create a world in the way that Ursula Le Guin is incomparable. Doing, and
Garcia Marquez,
and
very
Marquez,
famous
yes.
for that. Faulkner, even
yes, all of it. You know, you really do. You're part of that world, and then there's the interaction with the environment, the landscape, the geology, weather, everything. So I wanted to create a world, and that's what I did. But it's funny you should. It's funny you should say that, you know, you looked up that.
I tried.
You know, because what happened was I was doing an appearance in Boston, and I read the piece and so on. And then afterwards, a young woman came up to me who seemed quite agitated, actually. And she said, while you were reading, I Googled Highway 117. And she said, and it's not where you say it is, and it's only a half mile long. What do you have to say to that? And I said, fiction! to paraphrase Picasso, lies are what artists create in order to create the truth or uncover the truth. I thought to myself, wow, I really was doing a terrible job, at least for that young woman, if she was more interested in sitting there Googling facts. But as far as what's true, the light is true. The light in the desert. That
plays a big part in the book.
Oh, yeah.
You have a beautiful line about that. The preacher knew what he was talking about. The desert is home to light.
Yes. Yes.
Because you had originally discussed it as it's an absence of water.
Right.
It's an absence of people.
And buildings.
And buildings and all that. But what it has is an abundance of light.
Of light.
So let's just take the main character and the narrator, Ben Jones.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting origins. He's the son of a Jewish social worker. That's his mom, his birth mom.
Mm-hmm.
And the father is a Native American. And he was abandoned at birth or given up for adoption.
Mm-hmm.
How did you come up with that? A Jewish Native American. It might be the very first in literature, isn't it?
Well, one of the true lost tribes.
That's true. I didn't think of that.
Well, when you look back to Ben is about 38 years old. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time on Warm Springs, a lot of time down in the Four Corners area of the Southwest. And especially in the 60s and 70s and so on, there were a lot of people flooding onto the reservations who wanted to help. And as laudable as that was, it created an atmosphere that sometimes was not healthy. People don't always want somebody to show up to save them. They want to be left alone with integrity and to live their lives and so on. So, you know, we have a Jewish social worker who's probably very young, and a Native American man. And for me, that gave Ben, there's a spiritual element to the book, that gave Ben a certain distinctive background, plus being an orphan. And then he's, of course, later adopted by an older couple who are Mormons.
We were talking off mic about a lot of mystery novels where the voice is just perfect. You've got, you know, Philip Marlowe's mm-hmm. voice in Raymond Chandler novels. Ben Jones is like that in this book. Hopefully we haven't seen the last of him. It seems like Philip Marlowe, Chandler wrote several books. Of course, you've got Spencer. Robert Parker wrote several books with Spencer. Will we be seeing more of Ben Jones?
Yes. My answer to that question has been, well, you know, I've been writing novels for years, just not publishing them. And, you know, because this novel was rejected by everybody who had a pen that could reject it, basically, except for one. You only need one. And
I just have to interrupt. It just amazes me because in addition to being beautifully written, it's extremely entertaining. It's a page turner.
I think part of this is, and Ursula Le Guin's been writing a lot about this lately, is that people like stuff that's one way. This is not really a mystery. It's not a standard tightly plotted genre mystery. It's not exactly a romance. It's not exactly environmental didacticism. You know, it's got all these things. And so if you're looking for something that you can market to one particular kind of audience, this isn't it. So I do understand that. But to answer your question, I didn't sit down to write a mystery novel. I sat down to write the best novel I could. And so it does have elements of this and it does have elements of that. And I will write another Ben novel. Depending on how well this one does, will determine whether it gets published or not. So one will exist. I just don't know.
I hope to see it.
Thank you so much.
We hope to read it. We've been talking with James Anderson, author of the new novel, The Never Open Desert Diner. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to James for visiting us at KBOO and for all of you for listening. Believing is living.